You have located GeekFest Rants, the entertainment podcast for genre geeks like you.
Shall we play a game?
Covering the world of vintage and current film and television since 2010.
Game over, man! Game over!
Featuring in-depth conversations on sci-fi, horror, fantasy, comics, toys, and conventions.
So say we all!
So say we all!
And now sit back, relax, and enjoy today's show.
American Graffiti. Where were you in 62?
Special one and jump into your candy-colored custom or your screaming machine, cruise downtown and catch American Graffiti.
American Graffiti.
Baby, what's that?
It's a movie.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Go back in time.
Where were you in 62?
Is that you in that beautiful car? Jeez, what a waste of machinery.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around 10 o'clock tonight.
What did you say? Someone wants me. Someone roaming the streets wants me.
And I bet you're smart enough to get us some brew.
A ballpoint pen, a pint of old Harper.
Okay, you got an ID for the liquor?
Not, I left it in the car.
You'll have to get it before.
Oh, well, I forgot the car.
We're finally getting out of this turkey camp. You just can't stay 17 forever.
If you ever get tired of going steady with somebody that ain't around, I'm up for grabs.
Well, that'll be the day.
If I had a boyfriend, he'd pound you.
Friendly rhyme. Tears I cannot
cry. What's wrong?
Get your boogaloos out, baby. The Wolfman is everywhere.
16 candles.
You know Toby Juarez?
We killed him last night.
Excuse me, I think we've had an accident.
Well, I won't report you this time, but next time, just watch it, will you?
I can dig it.
It's one of those great old movies about romance, racing, and rock and roll.
Oh, American Graffiti. American Graffiti. Where were you in 62?
Hi, everybody, and welcome once again to GeekFest Rants. My name is Carlos Peron, and today we are going to take a look at a couple of movies that are very important in terms of on their own and then what they led to, specifically the first one. And I'm talking about American Graffiti, the George Lucas hit that he had before Star Wars, what gave him the street cred, if you will, you know, to be able to then go on and do Star Wars. And then we are going to look at more American Graffiti. Joining me today, I'm going to have our friend and co-host James, who is going to help us go over these two films. I am a somewhat lukewarm fan of these films, specifically the first one. And the second one, I had not seen either ever or in a long time. I honestly can't remember. But without any more delays, let's get started with American Graffiti.
What did I teach you?
You are the Duke of New York. You are A number one.
You will not laugh. You will not cry. You will learn by the numbers. I will teach you.
Can you dig it?
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
That spawn of Satan!
force will be with you, always.
Okay, today, as I mentioned, we have James with us. Say hi, James.
Hello, hello.
We are tackling James's suggestion of American Graffiti. Now, this is a movie that originally I was thinking of doing like a non-Star Wars Lucas, and this definitely falls under that realm, but obviously, genre-wise, this is, you couldn't get any further away from something like Star Wars or even Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, when you go the American Graffiti route and its sequel. And this is historically the movie that gave them the traction, you know, to be able to move on and do Star Wars and, you know, all his future projects. But we do know that before this, that there was THX 1138, which was the movie that, you know, he did in school, that when he joined up with Coppola, that was the first movie that he was contracted to shoot, which technically was somewhat of a bomb because it was apparently a very artsy-fartsy kind of reception in terms of people were like, this is way too highbrow.
It's still even too hard to access.
Yeah, it's a tough movie.
And I'm an adult. I'm a grown man now, and I should understand life better. And I didn't get it when I saw it the first time, and if I watched it today, I'm sure I don't know what's going on.
And from what I remember, Coppola was the one that said to him, you know what? You need to do something a little more commercial, a little more that people can kind of grab onto.
I think his comment was, you need to make a comedy or something like that. Like, it was like something, you just have to do something different.
And overall, like, I just rewatched the first film yesterday, and I watched the second film, I don't know if I, for the first time, because a lot of it looked very new to me. And I'll tell you, off the bat, I'm not a big fan of the first film. I understand it's a comedy. I get it. It's a comedy. It's very different than traditional comedies. It's all shot at night. And it almost has a documentary feel to it because it's very rough. You jump into scenes that are already started. And I understand that's part of that 60s.
And that's also George's style at the time.
Yeah.
He kind of wanted to be almost a documentary filmmaker or
like you're walking
a
into
war
a scene,
correspondent filmmaker.
Right, in the middle. You're walking into the middle of a
Gorilla.
Conversation and you're like, wait, what's going on? What are these people? And they're talking about nonsense and stuff like that. But anyway, why don't you tell me about, what your background with this film is?
Well, I requested you to let me do this show because of, A, my penchant for basically covering anniversaries of certain films that meant a lot to me, as we've done over the years to many of our favorites. And this is the 50th anniversary this past couple weeks. It was the beginning of August 1973, the movie came out. But also, I kind of love this period of time that the movie represents. Maybe because it was maybe my father's time, maybe because it's a simpler time. Nothing to do with politics or anything like that, or like, it was an easier, everything was better. Just coolness in terms of cars, girls, hanging out and, just Americana in a way. And obviously everybody's got a different point of view depending on where and how they grew up. But this is George's version of it, how he grew up. And I feel I loved this era by default because people who grew up in the 70s were kind of spoon-fed that throughout nostalgia because the play Grease first and then the movie Grease. Happy Days, which kind of bounces back and forth, and we could do a whole show on that, but it really didn't come from this, but it ultimately got picked up because of this.
Yeah.
And Ron Howard's connection to the pilot of what eventually became Happy Days, and then, so he played Richie and then became Steve, and then which allowed him to become Richie and then became the Ron Howard that we know, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, the whole thing, the whole era, the nostalgia of the 50s and early 60s, that doo-wop and rock, early rock and roll and everything like that really kind of like rubbed off on me in that period of time and a lot of people we know. So, you like Grease, you probably liked Happy Days, even though you didn't grow up with it as much, but you've seen it, you got something out of it. Maybe you like the Fonz or whatever. And I would say these two kind of fed off each other. So that makes it easy for me to love because I love both. However, so for me, this movie came out in 1973. Obviously, I was a little too young for it. My parents had seen it, I'm sure, in the theater when it came out because, like I said, my father grew up in this era of sorts and similar age. Almost exactly similar age as George Lucas. And as a result of Star Wars, so as you said, this movie kind of opened the doors for George to be able to make Star Wars because this became the number one low-budget independent film, whatever you want to call it, of all time at that point. You know, obviously, it's changed since then. But that opened the door for Star Wars. We get Star Wars in 77. George Lucas is, you know, God now. And so Universal wants to re-release the movie. And this period after Star Wars, as we've talked about, is just legendary. And especially for us, like, we were sponges of everything that came after that, not just science fiction, but so many different things and actors and George Lucas and Steven Spielberg in the period of time there. So many doors opened. And this movie was re-released in May of 78. And that's when I got to see it in the theater in this big re-release. You know, they gave it a big push re-release, which was 5 years later. But like I said, that Happy Days was the number one show, or at least high up there. Laverne Shirley became one of the top shows. Grease was either still coming out or about to come out or had just come out. So this, but it was a number one Broadway play. People were going gaga over it on Broadway for years. And so this was a great time for this to be re-released. And the music and the whole feel of that time in the late 70s. And so I fell in love with it because of the cars, because basically it's like watching Happy Days with just, you know, slightly different characters and stuff. Paul LaMatt was John Milner. Falfa was Harrison Ford. And obviously, so, you know, 5 minutes of him, but I'm getting to see Harrison Ford, Han Solo, in the big screen doing something cool with all these other cool guys. But John Milner is basically a Fonz-type character. Cindy Williams is Lori, and that's basically Shirley. So there's a lot of connections. I think One Day at a Time had come on, so Mackenzie Phillips was already becoming a star, and so on and so forth. And Richard Dreyfuss was in Jaws and so many other movies that after that, you know, his career boomed. So I was totally familiar with him too. So this was fantastic, a fantastic time for this to come out, for almost to me to connect to these other characters. And so it was a big deal. It was, you know, it was promoted, obviously, you know, the guy, Star Wars. Plus, you know, Mike, I actually remember my parents saying, oh, we have to go see this. You're going to love it. It's like Happy Days, you know, we love the music, stuff like that. It's going to be great.
I didn't come back to this until similar to yourself, but way, way, way later, you know, probably on video, I imagine, in some shape or form,
sure.
Because I didn't get here till 79. And, you know, I was in complete Star Wars mode, you know, right off the plane. So when I started going backwards and trying to grab all his old stuff, that's when I came to this. But even before this, I had already grabbed onto, you know, I always say I was raised on television because, you know, Happy Days was already playing, you know, and, you know, actual new shows and the repeats, you know, on syndication.
And you liked Happy Days, right? You didn't grow up in America, but you got it all, right? You understood it all. You got the gist.
Right.
Of
once
it,
I,
sure.
I, yeah. Once yeah. I got
it's
here,
universal.
I started.
It's a universal story, you know, of American
right.
family.
And that was
you basically became an American family.
That was the closest for me, at least, to see what this 50s thing was all about, because obviously it wasn't my nostalgia. My nostalgia is
sure.
now thinking about the 70s and the 80s.
And it really wasn't even my dad's other than the music. It was a moment in time, in a place in time of the halcyon days of the 50s, which, like I said, was different in California. It was different in New York City where my father grew up. It was different probably in any place in America had a different version of that. But the car culture, the hanging out at the drive-in diners and the picking out, trying to pick up girls riding around town and cruising, as they called it, and stuff like that, which kind of opened up other movies. You know, like the Coolie High version was the, I guess, was the black version, the inner city version of the 50s and 60s. And then there was The Lords of Flatbush was probably a New York version of that with Stallone and actually with Henry Winkler, who eventually plays the Fonz. And that's how those two got connected years later. And the Fonz was popular and helped Stallone get Rocky seen by some people, you know, in Hollywood. So all this is very, it fed off each other with a bunch of different stuff and gave a lot of people a career or blossomed their career or enhanced their career. And I even say Suzanne Somers, who was the ingenue in the T-Bird riding around. And I love the fact that George, and I'm bouncing around because I'm so excited, but I love the fact that George, like, leave him wanting more. He could have had them hook up. He could have had them meet. He could have had a whole scene, but you only see glimpses and you see the car, and everybody loves the car. and the, you know, can tell she's pretty good looking just based on her blonde hair and a little bit of silhouette you get and a little bit of the nose or whatever. And the whole, that whole little section is just magical. And she became a superstar as a result after that too, eventually doing some stuff. And then Three's Company, where, you know, she skyrocketed to fame.
I can see also how, you know, like nowadays people complain that, oh, you know, everybody's addicted to nostalgia and everything is something that's being remade. And this thing about everybody wanting to relive the 80s, you know, all these movies.
Yeah.
Were there.
And that always burned me. That burned my butt because they do that now.
But I could see how even back then, that's exactly what this movie is it's reliving, you know, people in the 70s thinking about the 50s, you know. They're thinking of their childhood, and I could see how, even though, again, it's not my cup of tea, even the way the movie is made, you know, having a nostalgic feelings for that. I, you know, if I think of the 50s, I rather think of Happy Days, or I rather think of Back to the Future, even though it's completely fictional, but it's my image of it. But I guess this is a little more accurate and more realistic. And even then, I'm looking at these scenes of people cruising, and I'm like, what the hell is the point of this? They're just driving.
That's it. There was no point. It's just teenagers having nothing
just, like,
to do.
Just yelling at each other and throwing crap at each other.
And goofing. Just basically goofing on a Friday or Saturday
and daring
night.
Each other to race, to go somewhere because else and have a drag race.
It's probably, at the time, it's probably an American thing of cars and kids and teens with let's say a little bit of disposable income, because the 50s were considered a generally prosperous time for many people, not everybody. So kids having cars. Before that, cars weren't that plentiful. In Europe and other countries, cars weren't that prolific. I'm sure you being in South America at the time, into the 70s, you probably, I don't know how many teens you hung out with because you were a younger kid, but you probably saw older teens. I don't know how many of them had cars. I'm sure there was some, because, like, I know Cuba had cars and they still have the same cars from that era.
Again, I grew up in the 70s. No car, no telephone. If we had to make a phone call, we would go to somebody else's apartment.
So that's why I say it's very Americana. And that was why I say it made it seem magical. Where now, like in the 60s, there was the specter of Vietnam War. In the 70s, there was the gas crisis. So the cars became actually a burden. And then there was the malaise and, you know, inflation and all that nonsense. And then in the 80s, it sort of came back, because I can remember by the middle 80s having a car when I turned 17, going and riding around with my friends. But, you know, then by then, you know, we're doing different stuff or going to hang out at different people's houses or riding wherever we're riding to, you know, maybe bowling and stuff. But it's essentially the same thing. It basically was like just many years different later with cooler cars. Well, I wouldn't even call them cooler cars, but newer modern cars and, you know, reliving some of that, I suppose.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the 50s. And this is actually the early 60s. This is like 1962, which is still, it's still no Vietnam. It's the tail end of that nostalgic period of time, what we know as the 50s. And that kind of started to fall apart. This is the early Kennedy era, and I guess the death of President Kennedy, the assassination of President Kennedy, woke everybody up from that dreamlike feeling. And now reality is that this is a sad time, a realistic time, and then the Vietnam War became more realistic to a lot of people, and then, you know, civil rights and all that. You know, then it's a whole different thing. You go from, say, being a teenager to now being, oh, this is life, this is realism, and war is hell, and all that kind of crap that, you know, the 60s brought, you know, and the change of the culture and everything like that. So I guess that's why people find it a nostalgic time.
Well, let's break it down a little bit in terms of, there's multiple stories that are being told during this one night. Everything takes place basically the night before one of these kids is about to fly off to college.
Well, two of them are supposed to go. Yes. And it turns out that these are all close friends or family, family members or people that are related in location. You know, there are people, you know, hey, I know that guy, or that guy's the older guy with the cool car, you know, this kind of stuff. And so this is the interaction of sort of their last hurrah, last big nights. There's, you know, there's a dance. They're going to come to the – it's really awkward that the dance is supposed to be in August, but maybe it's like a starting of the new school year dance, so the old people get to come back and say their last goodbyes if they're going to college or whatever their story is. And then, you know, there's a young girl, like she's 12, and she wants to tag along. Every little kid wants to tag along. So the older sisters, toss her off to the Fonz type guy, to the cool guy with the car, and he's like, oh man, what the heck happened to me? I'm trying to pick up, girls, and he winds up babysitting. But they wind up forming a bond and a great relationship throughout this movie. That really, it's innocent and it's fun and it's nice. And nowadays, and even back then, the studio wanted George to have more violence or more accidents or more. I don't know if they wanted sex, but they definitely wanted more like drama in this world. And it's like,
but even now watching it, it's there are a couple of kind of like border creepy scenes, because this girl is very young, and
well,
and
it's
he knows
creepy now because of what the world has become, but back then it didn't. I mean, well, we say back then, I'm sure the bad stuff was happening was just being hidden more or something like that, but yeah, there's no intention of this guy to want to hook up with her. I never get that vibe, but you could see where a creepier guy could turn this into a creepier situation.
He pretends to get kind of creepy in order to get her to tell her where she lives, to take her home.
And then she dug, and then she realized, look, I had fun. I'm going home. Yeah.
But your main character really is the Ron Howard character and the Cindy Williams character. They're like the prom king and queen kind of thing. And he's definitely supposed to be the guy that's going to college, because he's trying to talk Richard Dreyfuss into doing the same thing.
Yeah, Richard Dreyfuss thinks he's going to blow it off, maybe. Maybe he's having second thoughts. And we've all been there. I mean, at least I know I've been there. It's like your whole life is based on you're going to go to college when you graduate high school. And then it's like you get there. It's like, well, am I? Do I want to go there? Maybe there's something different. Maybe I'd be cool to go get a job or, whatever. So, and that was their back and forth between the two friends. And then there's another friend who, back at that point, we'd call him a dork or a nerd.
Yeah,
now,
Terry.
Who knows what they call him. But he was a friend, but he wasn't like a close, tight friend of the two guys. He wasn't tight friend. He was more like an acquaintance of the cool guy, Milner. And he winds up having an adventure with Steve's car, and then it gets stolen. Again, the coolest car in the... A lot of people like the yellow 32 Deuce or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's an Impala. And it's this white, beautiful Impala that's a little customized.
With fins everywhere,
paint.
And
that's one of the coolest cars of that era, like the late 50s. And that's Ron Howard's character's car. And somehow you think ultimately he's driving it for him, because Ron Howard's got to hang out with his girlfriend, because they wind up having this struggle now in their last night. Are they going to stay together?
Right. And he's also telling him that once he's gone, he can have the car. He can look after the car. So he wants to kind of break it in and take it for a ride.
And then hijinks ensue. And he winds up meeting a kind of cute girl, and a girl that's probably a little more around town. I'm not going to call her anything bad.
Candy Clark, who plays Debbie.
Yes. And I'm not going to call her anything bad, but she's probably a little bit more worldly than Toad. But Toad wants to be cool. They go out, they want to get some alcohol. They want to, it's one of my favorite scenes of the movie. It's like, I'd like some razor blades. I'd like some gum, a bottle of old granddad. It's like, the guy goes, the guy's packing it all up, and he's like, okay, I need your ID. Just very nonchalant, because he thinks he's scoring. And the guy's like, yeah, can I have your ID? And he's like, it's in the car. And then it winds up being a gunfight. The guy's robbing the place, and he kind of gets the booze as a side thing, like a little by accident almost. They go off, have a little time, maybe they're going to fool around. He thinks they're going to fool around, and next thing you know, the car's stolen. And then it's a whole adventure of having to find the car. And this is all happening in one night, you said,
in a couple of hours.
And into the wee hours. And then I guess after all these different interactions, there's two really, I call them, great denouements. Okay, so the first one is there's a new guy in town. There's a guy from out of town. He's in town. He wants a race. He's looking for John Milner, because John Milner supposedly got the coolest, fastest car. But this guy, and that's Harrison Ford. And there's kind of like,
he's more of a country guy, like the cowboy.
Yeah, they're kind of circling each other through various accents, kind of getting near each other, and then finally they get near each other. And they're like, all right. We got a race. And Milner really doesn't want a race. He's starting to get tired of this thing. He's had a nice time hanging out with the girl's sister. And eventually, okay, we got a race. It's like, you got a race. Otherwise, you're chicken or whatever you want to call a guy who decides to maybe use good judgment. But he has to race. So they wind up at a dredger. While that's happening, Richard Dreyfuss is looking for the girl he got a glimpse of by accident in the T-Bird, and he's doing everything he can, and then he sees another glimpse and knows somebody who's seen her and might know who she is. He goes to the radio to get the Wolfman. Well, in one of the nicest scenes, you know, we know who he is, but nobody knows who he is back then. They're not supposed to know who the Wolfman is. Mysterious voice, you know, he's got this, you know, this voice, and he's kind of like a sexy sound, and he's playing the best music and everything like that. He goes there, he meets the Wolfman, but he doesn't think he's just some regular guy. He's just playing the cards of the Wolfman and stuff. And it's really a nice scene. As he leaves, he gets a glimpse of it, and it's the and he realizes it really is the Wolfman. And, you know, it's a good feeling for that part of the story. And then the girl winds up calling him. You know, no, we're not going to meet up. We're not going to hook up. But, you know, sometime we'll run into each other, you know.
At one point, somebody was telling him that, oh, yeah, she's married. And, you know, and they're like, well, you shouldn't approach
her. There's all kinds of legend who she is. There's all kinds of legend. Like, who is she? Oh, she's this. Oh, maybe she's a stripper. Oh, maybe she's an exotic dancer. Or maybe she's, like you said, somebody, some rich guy's wife. You know, we don't know. And that's the best part about it. We don't need
The other thing about Kurt is before he gets to finally meet Wolfman Jack, which is another whole thing, is that this movie is packed with songs that I'm sure somebody had to jump through crazy hoops to get the rights.
Cost some money. That's where
I was
going to
say that's a lot of
and
a lot of
they needed
hits.
The music and George. They wanted him to use like covers and stuff. And George, what I know, George was adamant that no, we need to have the music. We've got to find a way. And there were one or two songs I recall reading anecdotally that they just couldn't use. I don't remember which one, but it was like, wait. And it's not even something that we don't miss it, but it might have been something important to him, to his era, to his growing up. But they couldn't use it just because it got something like.
And also the other thing is that obviously they can plop in whatever song as background, but there is one scene, and I forget which one of the characters is actually singing a song, mouthing
some
the song.
Enchanted Evening.
So it's like, okay, you got to get
you
this, or you can't use your
song. And that's Harrison Ford. Harrison Ford. And it was, and they that's one of the ones that did cost them some money because they were very protective of that. I guess with Rodgers and Hammerstein, it was very important to them, I guess. But so they had to pay that. It's like when people want these Beatles songs. If you really need it, it's going to cost you. it's very rare that they allow you.
The thing about that I was saying before about Kurt, the Richard Dreyfuss character, is that before he meets Wolfman Jack, is he has a run-in with like a couple of like greasers, let's say.
Well, yeah, he's a straight-laced kid. He's supposed
Bob
to be the
Hopkins,
straight-laced guy.
Who plays Joe, who ends up showing up in the next film too, and who kind of joins them into, because he thinks he's going to get his ass kicked basically a couple of times because they claim he scratched the guy's car, which he probably didn't, but they're just roughing him up. But then he kind of joins them
He becomes an unofficial pharaoh.
to play a trick on the cops, which ends up destroying the cop's car in the process.
Yeah, so for one night, he's a badass. You know, like he's a town tough.
I know.
And all that in that whole period of time, like I said, he's known as like a collegiate straight, but then like he winds up pulling a prank while they're trying to rob the pinball. You know, what we grew up with, I guess, was the video arcade, like Flynn's arcade. The old school version of that in the 50s and 60s would have been the pinball gallery or pinball arcade, you know, whatever they called it. So he saves the pharaohs from getting in trouble because like, oh, Kurt, these are your friends? Oh, okay, yeah. You know, you're fine. Good, be good. Good luck in college, you know, that type of thing. So it's like this whole kind of things go accidental that winds up going their way, but not in a stupid kind of movie kind of way like we're used to. It's just in a way that's kind of fun and wholesome, I guess, you know, by the end.
It's a harmless story up until the last 5 seconds.
I didn't know if you were going to bring that up yet.
Yeah.
So that's that. So at the end, the race is over. Falf has crashed his car with Cindy Williams in it. Ron Howard, Steve get back together and they're crying. Right. We're never going to leave each other. Oh, so he decides not to go to college. It's the complete opposite now.
Right.
Kurt Richard Dreyfuss is going to go to college. He sort of had the moment with the blonde, even though he still didn't meet her, but he only talked to her. But again, it's the 50s. They didn't need to have the hot, heavy night together.
And even from the plane, it looks like he's seeing her drive away.
And there's that magical thing. Is she going where he's going? Does she really know it? Like, you can imagine anything. Like, I've heard fan fictions afterwards, like they hook up later because that's why you never see him again, and he becomes famous writer or whatever, because that's what he was wanted to be, I guess. And I think they even say stuff. So ultimately, the last slate of the four things pop up. It says what happens to Ron Howard. It says what happens to Toad. It says what happens to Kurt. And then it says what happens to John Mill. And it really actually ends on a down note. And it's very moving.
Let's
it's
talk
very
about moving.
It. If you never watch anything or do anything with this movie and these characters again, it's kind of sad. But it's
but let's talk about it, because happens. This is what leads to the second film. This information is what springboards
a second
the second
film. Yeah. A sequel?
Oh yeah. So Ron Howard's character, they tell you he gets, you know, they get married and he's like an insurance salesman.
Yep.
So he's got a good happy ending in the slate. Then you have Richard Dreyfuss's character, another happy ending. He moves to Canada and becomes a writer.
Well, it's sort of a happy ending, and he moves to Canada probably to avoid the Vietnam War.
There you go.
It's implied because people of the era who know what's what, many people either went to Canada to avoid the war, many people got deferments in some manner, and other people wound up in the Vietnam War. And who winds up in the Vietnam War?
Well, Toad.
Exactly. And Toad is the last character you'd expect who would end up in the Vietnam War.
Exactly. And what's interesting is that
nothing
the
leads
slate,
up to that. Nothing gives us a hint. There's no hint
nothing.
In the movie that
no.
he would be militaristic or go
no,
and
no,
join.
No.
It's just another twist of fate of the 60s, right. How people got caught up in a war that probably was unnecessary, probably was ill-fought ill-defined in terms of what was needed, ill-conceived. So Terry winds up there.
But what's interesting about him is that the slate does not say that he died. It says that he's missing in action in the Vietnam War.
Which is also, see, and George grew up in that era or with people of that era, and that happened a lot. I mean, I say a lot, but a lot more than you'd want. People don't want to lose their loved ones. And they certainly, when they do lose them, they want to know, okay, this is what happened. They're gone. They have closure. Missing in action people, there's still families who don't know what happened. Many years later, remains have been found. And they at least thank God that they've got that little bit of closure, because until then, they don't know. And what could have happened?
So let me ask you a question. Do you think that the reason they made him, at least George Lucas, for this first film, the reason he made it missing in action was because, like you're saying, it's another way of making it even more tragic? Or do you think it was the, hey, maybe if he's missing in action, then maybe he's not dead?
Well, there could be two ways. Assuming he thought about a potential sequel, he's one of the main four stars. So yes, you keep him available by not saying what happened. One of them, well, we didn't even say it.
It's the Han and Carbonite theory.
But John Milner is sadly killed, is listed as killed by a drunk driver.
A drunk driver, right.
It wasn't originally, the original release, it wasn't New Year's Eve, but it turned out because Terry was missing in action at New Year's Eve of 1965.
Yeah, there's a difference in dates.
When the re-release, they changed it. And then, because I think they were thinking of a potential sequel, or at least to make it bookend type of thing, that Milner died by a drunk driver. Nothing he did wrong, by a drunk driver killing him, which again was becoming a bad thing that happened because the fun times were ending in the 60s and everybody thinks of the good times, but bad things were happening. War, drunk driving, people with having to leave home, people, you know, having drugs and drug problems. So do I think George considered, I think it was probably two prong. A, he's one of the main stars. So if they were going to do a sequel, it doesn't kill two people off. It just leaves an open end what happens. And the other thing is that sadly, some of that happened. You know, people lost family members that they never found out how it ended or what happened.
So in typical George Lucas manner, this movie, the executives are like, oh, this is crap.
Yeah, yeah, just like in Star Wars.
Yeah, George is scared to death. This is a bomb. And the thing just explodes.
There was times even talking about, this is not worthy of a theater. How about we release it on TV? How about, you know, there various other options where they were trying to salvage. And then like, no, let's just do it. They did it. Almost, you know, it was testing well. It's like almost like, all right, let's just get it out. Get it out there, whatever happens. It was a blockbuster. It was an unbelievable blockbuster for the amount of money and time it took to make it. And it made him a folk hero. And like when you hear this now, like a Robert Rodriguez, you know, or a Clerks, you know what I mean? It's like the essential, it's like the earlier version of something like that. You know, so he becomes a legend. And doors at least start opening.
Right. And it also bankrolls Zoetrope Studios, which you know, got off to a rocky start, and now they can do a little more fiddling around because, you know, they're not necessarily under the gun anymore.
There are stories about how Francis should have paid for this, but Francis had his own. He was an executive producer because they needed, you know, it's just like now they need names and who can attach to the names. Yeah. Okay, well, who you got? You got John Travolta? Oh, okay, we got John Travolta. We can green light this. And, okay, see, who else do you got? You got Tom Cruise. Oh, okay. So good. So that kind of got it made because he was at least kind of, he wasn't bankrolling it, but he was overseeing it. So he had a name at least.
Right.
George wasn't quite George yet. But after that, obviously Godfather allowed Francis to do a lot of stuff, but it also allowed him to go with American Zoetrope and make, he didn't get rich off of it, but he got some money and it allowed him to do other things and go in other directions, like with Apocalypse Now and Something of the Heart. What is that one, you know?
Well, ironically, I know that at one point, Lucas's name was being thrown around for doing the Vietnam film.
Yeah, it was supposed to be like a documentary style.
Necessarily the sequel to this, but something having to do with Vietnam. And, you know, eventually Coppola did it. But what's really a coincidence is that once they moved now to this sequel, which Lucas has nothing to do, he's still an executive producer and it is based on his character.
Well, he does have a little to do with it because of it's his characters, but he kind of is farming it out because his world is Star Wars now.
Right, and it's owned by Universal. Universal owns the rights.
So it's kind of, he's attached. They're going to sell a sequel as the creator of Star Wars to get people to remember. If they hadn't seen it, the first one, that's why they did the re-release. Then they can kind of, I call it, pimp it out with a name attached to it. You know, again, a name attached to it. And now how do you get these other, all these stars are superstars. So how do you get them?
Now, what's really weird is that, and because I checked the dates, more American Graffiti and Apocalypse Now kind of come out in the same year.
Yes. Well, Apocalypse Now took forever to film.
Yes.
But more American Graffiti is kind of happening around the time Empire Strikes Back is pretty hot and heavy in terms of pre-production and early production. You know, actually, the early days of production, they're doing some of this other stuff. So George can't be in two places. But okay, go ahead. What do you, you just saw this today. Yeah, what did you get out of it? I love it. It is different. It isn't everybody's cup of tea. And I understand anybody who doesn't love it, and it didn't make money at the time. It kind of came and went only because the 50s nostalgia and then the 60s nostalgia. The 60s nostalgia hadn't kind of come yet. The 50s nostalgia was wearing down. It was all, as we've said, it was all Star Wars. It was all sci-fi. It was all sci-fi, and now we're,
that's exactly the problem.
It wasn't a sci-fi movie, and it was 1979, and it wasn't a sci-fi movie.
No, it wasn't Star Wars,
Star Trek, or The Black Hole, or Buck Rogers.
That is precisely the problem, is that they're trying to redo the formula of the let's look back. Now, instead of looking at the 50s, let's look at the 60s. Well, I remember from the, you know, we didn't, Hollywood didn't go back to the 60s until the mid-80s. That's when they started having that nostalgia.
And I would call that around between the war movies in the 80s.
Yeah.
And the Wonder Years in like the middle late-ish 80s, and a couple of other movies that were more 60s-ish. Right. It was I don't remember the name of it, but it was like an ensemble cast, and it was like there were
the
tons of songs in it. The Big Chill, stuff like that was like, then we'll go back to the 60s. And I mean, there were other things too. I'm not saying it was all really, but it wasn't right this second. What, like there was like 10 years ago from today was the big superhero push. Well, that was all sci-fi. And if you didn't have a spaceship in it, it was really hard to get people's attention. It wasn't impossible, but then you better have had super superstars like Dustin Hoffman or somebody, or Richard Dreyfuss in it, who didn't come back for this sequel. So they make this sequel. And I remember it came out. I didn't go see it in the theater. I saw probably many years later, at least 5 years. So 79, maybe after, like in the middle 84-ish ballpark, I saw it on VHS finally, or HBO probably, but it could have been one or the other. But I definitely had to come back to it. I was just like you. It was all science fiction. I gravitated Battlestar, you know, any of these things. And American Graffiti was kind of, I love the movie, 78, obviously. I love seeing it. I love Happy Days still, because that went on till about 82 or 84, one of the two. I had like, you know, 350 episodes. But I don't think I could have gotten myself to that. I went to other things that weren't Star Wars movies, but it was things like Sergeant Pepper or something like that, which obviously wasn't that great either, but that had Beatle influence. You know, the stuff we've talked about, that you into Saturday Night Fever and Grease and things, these are things that, you know.
Can't stop the music.
Yeah, these are just, I don't know, and who knows why we pick those over one or not the other, but That's why I didn't see it in the theater. Oh, I know why. Like, Jaws 2 came out in 78. I'm trying to think of other things came out. There were other things grabbing our attention. And if it wasn't Star Wars or science fiction, well, it had to rise to a higher level. And it didn't.
Well, this movie tries to take a similar path as the first one in terms of, let's tell four different stories. So this time around, you're dealing
with four different years, even.
It's different times because
different times, different film styles, which I consider how Oliver Stone did stuff sometimes.
And because some characters are already dead.
Film stocks. Yeah,
because some characters are already dead, they can't overlap the story, so they have to tell it in different time periods. So let's go through them again so we know where we're at. You have Ron Howard.
So you didn't love it, right?
No.
You didn't love either one of them as much as I would have hoped.
No, I know, but I really did not like, but it's weird. I really did not like this second one. And I'll tell you when we get to that story.
Okay.
You have Ron Howard and Cindy Williams. They're married, and it's basically they're still having relationship issues. Plus,
and
they have kids.
This is considered in 67. So this has the more hippie vibe. Era.
Right. And their story is the one that goes kind of in that direction the most, especially for Cindy Williams. Out of the blue, she has to go and return something to somebody else, and she gets wrapped up in the whole counterculture protest movement kind of
Well, they throw in, and this is historically when it starts, the woman's lib thing. So we've gotten through each person can say, but like, we've gotten through the early 60s, Kennedy's dead, the Vietnam War, and now we're supposed to be in like the woman's lib era and the free love or at least looser love and drugs and stuff like that. And she wants to become more of an independent woman. He wants her to be a housewife and a mother to the children. And so they have marital strife or at least marital tension in this. And you know, you can tell they love each other, but it looks like they're going to break up. It's almost that tough.
Now, Paul LaMatt's story is completely, completely separate because his is taking place earlier than this story.
He's in 64.
Right. And he's doing his racing. He's doing his professional racing, and he's having trouble because another guy is beating him, and he meets this girl.
I feel like it's like when Tony Manero ended Saturday Night Fever, and then the Tony Manero we find in Staying Alive. So he's not the local street racer anymore and the tough guy. He's now kind of cultivating a racing career.
Right.
In drag racing.
It's the typical big fish in a small pond, and now he's a small fish in a big pond.
And he's competing with other guys who've got, they say they got the factory sponsor and all this kind of stuff. And he's kind of like trying to compete with the skills, but not the wherewithals and everything like that. He's like really struggling to get there. And it turns out that, you know, he meets some interesting people, and it's just like a nice, sweet story for a guy who we know the ending is coming. It's like when we watch Anakin, you know where he's ending up. And sadly, we can't. The other people, we didn't all know what was going to happen exactly.
Right. Now, the thing is, because they couldn't get Richard Dreyfuss to come back, in my opinion, it looks like they kind of promoted Candy Clark's character, which is Toad's girlfriend, kind of.
Yes.
To a lead, to kind of run her own story, which kind of coincides with the whole hippie thing.
And I'm not against that. It is interesting how she was more like I don't want to call her a floozy because, like I said earlier, I didn't want to put names on it. But she was kind of like a how about Flitty? Yeah. She was like a flitty girl, and now she's got to be a little bit more, like make a live, like she's real life.
She reminds me of Forrest Gump's girlfriend that keeps like going from guy to guy.
She's in this whole counterculture era. And she's in San Francisco or that sphere, that area. And her story is in 66, so it's definitely creeping into that whole drug scene, more hippie scene and stuff like that.
And the final lane that we have here, it's Terry, it's Toad in Vietnam. And this is the one that I found the most bad of all of them.
Okay.
Because they definitely, because of his character, they do take the comedic approach to his story. And I found it really bad, or I don't even want to say the word offensive, to try to make the Vietnam War part of the story, the comedic part. I really did not like that.
I get your point because a lot of people don't even realize this. One of the main supporting characters of the first movie, Bo Hopkins, actually gets killed in the early scenes of the Terry scenes.
Yeah, right. Like, he gets shot right in front of him.
Like almost like, whoa, like blood splattered on him. It like shakes him up. And I think that, in the context of the movie, you might not even realize that was him, perhaps the average viewer. But that kind of woke Terry up. It's like, no, this ain't going to work. I got to get out of here. I don't belong here. This war is crazy. So, I get that. I get that. I could see at the time where it was even a little confusing with the four different eras and there were four different film styles. The war scenes were shot on like 16, Super 16 or 16.
Yeah.
The grainy war stock handheld. George Lucas even did some of that setup. The parts that he did participate in, that was some of the stuff he did because that was his forte. He loved doing like guerrilla documentary war style photography and editing and the way they had to do that.
Plus, what also bothered me is that obviously budget wise, they couldn't go to the Philippines or Vietnam. Like,
yeah, so it doesn't feel
it looks like it's somewhere in California that they're shooting this.
It could be Ewok Village.
Yeah, no,
the precursor to Ewok Village.
It's like you're watching the A-Team, you know?
Yeah. The funny thing that I want to mention, and this is like one of those legendary stories that I consider a comedy fact, but who knows exactly? And it makes sense that it could be true, but I mean, I don't know. They filmed the race scenes in a drag strip racetrack in California.
Okay.
And to get the crowds on the days they need them, they tell people they're making a movie, the George Lucas movie, and they promise them Star Wars figures. So they get crowds to come and sit all day in the heat because they're going to get free Star Wars figures. Now, what they got, who they got, none of that, I don't know, but they probably had cases of these things to give out to the people or the kids or whoever was there to keep them sitting there all day, maybe a hot dog or two. But I had heard that was one of the lures to get people to sit there was the promise of some free Star Wars figures. And that was funny. And to me, I thought that was great based on all the stuff we've done.
Well, let's do the same thing we did for the first film. Let's see how the individual stories end up. Because we also end this film with another very similar looking, you know, flashcard at the end with everybody, with certain characters.
Well, some of them show the flashcard of the original flashcard, and then they add a few of these other things.
Well,
I think before we do the flashcard, I want to mention one or two things that I think the audience, if they ever do pick up this video, try to watch it. Each of these characters and the side characters, they do, some of them make appearances, and one of the characters, the strangest one that you think you'd ever get to make a cameo, and is uncredited, is Harrison Ford. And
That's right.
Officer Bob Falfa, motorcycle cop of San Francisco PD, or one of the I don't think it's Chips, but it's one of those groups, and it winds up, he's in a scene with
Candy
Clark, and they're hiding their weed and their drugs and stuff like that. And it turns out to be, you know, pretty cool. I think that got overlooked by the average bear. I think that was a pretty cool cameo that they got.
No, there's a lot of, and again, let me just rattle off a few names, but we're not going to go deep, but they're there. Scott Glenn, who's the same Scott Glenn that's super famous. He's got a role in it. Rosanna Arquette apparently has a role in it.
She plays one of the, you see her, you do get to see her, I think, in one of the hippie bar scenes or something like that. I think those people, they're doing the...
Yeah. D-Roy Lindo, and then you have an actor named Will Seltzer, who is apparently playing the brother of the Richard Dreyfuss character. So they were trying to kind of have some kind of a connection. He's the protester.
He's the younger version, younger brother of Kurt and Sidious.
Right. So let's start wrapping up the individual story. So let's start with Ron Howard. Ron Howard, once again, it's exactly the same flashcard. In other words, his picture, it says that he's a successful, you know, in life insurance investor.
And they show his wife, and they show Cindy Williams with him, right? Don't they?
Well,
the
they give her, because you don't have Richard Dreyfuss, she gets her own picture that says she's also in some
housewife
kind of
and a mom, well, no, or something
about a business that she's running, because part of the storyline had to do with the big fight had to do with her wanting to work and him being, I'm the man of the family, under my rule women shall not work, you know, that kind of bullshit, and that's the crux of their argument. And you get the feeling that by the end, after they go through this whole adventure of getting beat up and arrested and all kinds of stuff with the cops, that he kind of gives in and, you know, he's like, okay, she can do whatever she wants.
Well, it just shows, and again, in the 70s, especially that point in the 70s, was the tail end when almost, I wouldn't call it the tail end, we didn't know it was the tail end, but like the Equal Rights Amendment was a big thing throughout most of the 70s, and there was going to be an amendment to the Constitution for women, all these things. It wound up not passing as an amendment, but clearly, you know, glass ceilings were, if they weren't breaking, they were at least getting a little cracked. So this was showing how she was becoming more of a modern woman type of thing, not just a housewife from the 50s and 60s, how they were evolving. And I like that. I like that story. I get it. You know, it's it really, it, you know, it did mirror, the two of them did mirror things, you know, that probably were happening in America. Husbands and wives who were teenage sweethearts and now they had to live life and the struggles of the 70s, you know, and stuff like yeah. that. So in the late 60s and the 70s. So
now the Paul LaMatte story, after he wins, once again, he wins a race.
And this is the sweetest story.
Right. Because but the other thing we forgot to mention is while we're going through his story, he also meets a girl from Sweden or something.
Iceland. They don't know where she's from. They think right. she might be Sweden, maybe it's North. And it turns out that one of the cooks on the track or in the
he can speak the language.
She's from Iceland. I can speak to. Her name is Mary or whatever. And it was like, man, it was just. And he was really. They were having this cute relationship that would have probably turned into something. He may have helped settle him down, or she would have been there as his wife eventually. Perhaps you know you have these hopes. And you know, he wins out of sheer luck because of misfortunes of other teams. And then there were basically, say, five teams. And one of them might have been the factory sponsor team with all the big money and big parts. And then these other teams were competing and trying to be the next dog or at least try to get into that higher echelon. And he has a blowout and all the other team or something happens.
His parachute doesn't go off, so he crashes.
He crashes into a wall, and they all come together.
They have to cannibalize like another car to put it into the front of his car to kind of make it work.
Yeah, it's such a great feeling and feel good that everybody comes together for the local teams, kind of instead of fighting each other, come together to at least try to give it to stick it to the factory guys, and he wins. He wins, and it was just like a. Like out of nowhere, and he's on top of the world, and he meets this nice girl, and he's going to hopefully see her again. I guess, you know, a little peck on the cheek or something, whatever. And he rides off to go home. And it's New Year's Eve, and he's got to go home and wherever he's going. And we see the same ending scene of American Graffiti.
Here's what you see. You
riding
see
over the hills in Modesto.
You see the hills, and then you see there's another car or something coming opposite. And then they
I think
both-
they enhance it to make it look like he might be. There's headlights, and it maybe in this version. They were more pronounced that it was swerving a little bit, perhaps. Or something.
To me, it looked like they both at one point go down the hill, so you lose track of both headlights, his rear headlights and the other car's front headlights, and that fades away. And obviously, you do get the same slate as before that he died, and I guess we can assume that was the moment that happened, which makes it even sad.
It makes me sad, and I liked him. Now, I didn't find Paul LaMatte to be my hero or anything like that, but I liked him in the first movie, and I liked him in a couple other movies at the time. So he's a good guy. Like, I never got a bad vibe off of him. And so by the end of this movie, where his character winds up being one of the nicest, he grows, you know, he's the street tough, but he winds up growing up to be, like, really a thoughtful, good, caring guy. He wasn't a, you know, mean guy or anything. To have that, you know, fate befall him made it a sad scene, you know, in an otherwise kind of relatively... you know, uplifting movie, you know, but that's life, you know, it's life. These characters, sometimes friends don't make it, or they, you know, bad things happen.
Now, the Terry, the Toad character, the Vietnam story, from the beginning of the story, he's trying to wound himself to get out. He wants to get injured.
Well, I think of it as like a Klinger type of situation from MASH.
Which, again, it's so weird. It's so like the tone doesn't work.
He feels he doesn't belong there. He can't handle it. He's not a warrior. What am I doing? This is crazy. How am I going to get out of here? Am I going to shoot myself in the foot and maybe at least get R&R or get, I say Section 8. I don't know if it was called that in Vietnam, like it was in Korea, whatever. And he's trying all these different kinds of chaos. But in the meantime, and I can connect to his character, while this is all happening and he's trying to either find shortcuts or ways out, he's getting the ire of one of his... superior officer, sergeant, or somebody, or whatever.
Got a new like platoon leader,
lieutenant, the general.
Yeah, he's got a new guy that wants to kind of prove himself, and he volunteers him and the other guy to be like, okay, we're gonna do pickup, we're gonna do recovery pickups, and they're like, why? You know, why did you volunteer us?
So between having to get dead bodies, or having to clean latrines, or having to
they end up going down. That's the problem.
Somehow he comes up with the plan to make it seem like he dies in an explosion. Because I think there was earlier in this movie, there was some like they were getting shelled by the enemy. And he says, oh, well, this is bullshit.
This is after they get rescued and they brought back. And yeah. all the bigwigs are celebrating what a fantastic achievement it was. And obviously, these guys know exactly what happened. How many people did you kill? Nobody, but they're lying about it.
It's New Year's Eve, and we're going to give you latrine duty for Happy New Year. Just to stick it to him a little bit. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to stick it to him back. And he's thinking he's going to put poop in the cupcakes or something like that.
That's what I was thinking.
And he's going to make it seem like, or I don't know if he was making it seem like the latrines blew up, or it somehow.
Well, no, he was.
They turned a shed.
Well, they show you that he's working with some kind of an explosive, and then he brings out this huge cake. So you think, is he going to try to, like, is the cake full of crap and it's going to explode and get everybody full of crap?
But I then thought that.
That's
for
not
sure.
what happened. What happens is no. that the latrine where powerful. He's hiding, where he's working, explodes.
It's shelled, right?
No, yeah. no, it just explodes. Oh. And they found
right. no parts of him. So
right. They assumed that he died in that explosion.
Yep. And because there's no parts and there's no dog tags and there's no nothing, he's MIA. And that's how it ties back into
right.
it. So it's less sad because now he's going AWOL. Now he's
right. Then we know
he's
that
going,
the other guy
he's
is
going
helping
off
him
into
out.
The jungle and we're hoping. No, he yeah. could still die. Yeah,
that's another ridiculous scene where it's like, so his plan right. is to walk out of Vietnam? Are you out of your freaking
well,
mind?
Well, I guess in our heart and our mind, we're supposed to think good things. Of course, it could have been all horrible. He could have walked into a snare and blown himself up for real.
He said he's going to Europe. He's going to go live in
yeah,
Europe or something.
We hope he gets himself to Hong Kong and then off to Europe where he can hide out and be, you know, Joey the Frog instead of Terry the Toad in his alter identity or something. And
so his final end tag is exactly the same, that he's declared missing yeah. in action. We saw how he did it. Again,
Now we're less sad, at least.
That's how they wrote themselves out of it. So, okay, hey, that's what it was. But again, to me, out of all those stories, that the Vietnam one, it's like, I don't know, just the comedy was, it was inappropriate. It was just not the yeah. right tone.
I do get that. I do understand the irreverence was a little bit too, you know.
It's like, do they want us not to take it serious? Okay, maybe that's the yeah. whole, maybe they didn't want us to take it serious. But it's like, it seemed like a very important thing, even to them at the time. You know, to people of that age in the 70s or the 60s. So why would they make that choice to make that? I don't know. I guess somebody must know that somewhere.
And so by the end, like I said, we have got the wrap up of each of these characters, true to the ending of the first movie, but with more explanation of how it happens. You got the Steve and Cindy Williams. They're getting together, back together. They've gone through some drama of between anti-war protesting and the cops who were tough on the hippies. And there's all that kind of worked into their story. And they go off and it's New Year's Eve. So all these stories end around New Year's Eve of each year. And there's some reminiscing of like we lost our friend type of thing, whether it's implied or we're supposed to think of them thinking about it. And finally, of course, Candy Clark's character goes off to be a country and western singer yeah. with a new man, you know, a new gang. And they're all playing around and driving the van into garbage cans. And that's basically the official end, even though her story wasn't the last story of it. We don't know after that what happened other than the slates, and we hope for the best, I guess. And I just feel like in hindsight, at the time I didn't see it, and I probably didn't think of it, but in hindsight, I feel good about both of these.
This one didn't have as good music also as the other one, and you could probably tell it was probably the budget. They probably didn't have the money for it.
Yeah, they used more, obviously, 60s stuff, Stop in the Name of Love, so it's the Supremes, and it's you know, stuff like that, Glass Onion, different things like that. Just different, these more, like I said, more late 60s-ish vibes versus, and you know, versus the feel-good rock and roll, early rock and roll stuff. But, you know, I think they hold up of the eras. If you watch them together, like you did, I think you get a pretty whole story. But I'm disappointed and upset that you didn't like it as much as me. But I can understand it because I think the world felt more like you by the end of the second movie, even going back to it. I think I gave it more love because...
But again, was there a period, because you were here before me, was there a period where films in general were a little more lighthearted when it came to the subject of Vietnam?
Yeah. You got to think about it in the MASH, Hogan's Heroes.
No, I'm talking about the 70s. I'm talking about the 70s.
Yeah, I know, but there were times with...
See, but Hogan Heroes, here's the thing, because I thought of this. I thought of, well, yeah, they've made fun of movies, you know, the Great Escape and Hogan's Heroes. Yeah, but guess what? We won those wars.
Yeah.
This is a war that you got your ass kicked, and it was an embarrassment, and people are still pissed off about it. You can't joke about it, at least so
where Francis was showing, and they, like you said, they both came out around the same time, the second movie and Apocalypse Now. Francis was showing the really dark side of, and like the dark, seedy underbelly of the Vietnam War, which existed, but, you know, not everybody experienced.
And right. Then there's probably somebody whose Vietnam experience was sitting in an office building, you know, filing papers.
I had an uncle who, funny you mentioned that, exactly that thing. He was in Vietnam, did his time service, was in the war. He was in Vietnam, but it was more of a clerical type of thing.
Right, never saw anything horrendous.
The closest thing he said was to really heavy stuff. Was at some point they got a warning, they had to get out of some place where they were, and like maybe the barracks or something, or the office, that, and a bomb went off near it. It wasn't, and that, you know, lucky for him. Like I guess it depends on what, if you experienced it, and also if your family was involved and stuff. So I guess I saw it as just the funny parts of like MASH or something like that. I think that's probably what, that this is a stupid war. This was a horrible war that people had to endure for no good reasons. And in the end, this is how Terry, you know, got through it, or the silliness of the leaders. You know, they were trying to impress the congressman who came. Now, same BS. And I think that was what I think he was trying to make fun of. And it might have just, well, that was about 4 years after the official end of the war. You know, but so I guess they felt a little time had passed and they could be a little more lighthearted. But then, you know, it probably wasn't appropriate because we then were going to see 5 or 6, 7 year platoon.
The real, like, all Full those, Metal Jacket, Hamburger Ridge, all those movies. I would still recommend people especially see the first film, and I'd say watch the second, because you have to be able to see the progression of, does it, you know, in your eyes, does the second film measure up to the first?
Yeah, I don't think it's as good. I'll say that much. I think the first one's better. It's a sequel. It's a traditional sequel that doesn't measure up exactly. But I like the characters enough that I enjoy the story. And I do like each of those years and how they portray those eras, 64, 65, 66, 67, in a relatively realistic way that, you know, I wasn't there in 68. But, you know, I'm pleased in that aspect. Hearing, you know, the nostalgia of that period, and not just at all, you know, all drugs and, you know, chaos.
And even if you're not into the film like I am, in terms of I'm not a big fan of what's going on, from a historical perspective of a fan of George Lucas, to see the progression of his skill and his work, and how some of those items in this movie, whether it's the colors of the vehicles or certain characters, how they behave, how they kind of, a few things carried over to Star Wars, how certain mannerisms and certain, and the way that the film was edited, you know, the way, you know, having all these things happening at the same time.
Aren't there some early Dazzles, his style of Dazzles?
Yeah, there's a little
like
bit,
that?
just like THX 1138, there are little bits and pieces that you could kind of say, oh, look at that. That's from that movie. So,
and I'm sure you know it, but maybe the audience, our listeners, the yellow car eventually became Anakin, the yellow spaceships that we see.
His pod racer. Yeah, his pod racer.
I think if he could have gone back, he would have made, if he knew the significance or what he put the significance of the yellow car, maybe the land speeder would have been more yellowish.
Yeah, that, the land
I'm
speeder
glad,
and
I'm
also,
glad
the,
it wasn't.
Also the Y-wing with the engines being open so you could let the thing breathe and you could see it.
Yeah.
It's exactly what
and
that yellow
like
car
old
was.
Car, like the early car wouldn't have had that open like that, but then, you know, later on guys are hot rodding those rocket ships, you know.
And Luke
like
and
that.
His land speeder is the same version of the kid who's bored and all he can do is drive around, find his friends and hang
That's
out.
That's fact. The Luke having the land speeder, that was a fact that he said, look, this is what a teenager would do even on Tatooine.
Exactly. Well, you have any final thoughts about the film?
No, I'm glad we got to talk about it. It meant a lot to me as a film growing up and of that era. So I'm glad you were willing to give it a look and a first look in terms of more American Graffiti. A second look on the first one, a first look on the second one, whatever. And we can talk about it because it is important in the George Lucas pantheon. And it is important to me as something, you know, growing up and being a fan of that era. And like I said, maybe someday we'll do a show on Happy Days. Probably not, but at least we got our toe in that water because that was something that meant a lot to me.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest urban legends that most people think, a lot of people think that Happy Days is basically the TV version of this. And it's got, no, those things are completely separate. They have nothing to do with each other.
They were their own worlds, but one definitely helped the other. Yeah. And George looked at the pilot to see if Ron would be his guy. And so there's that tie-in. And then Hollywood producers said, oh, this movie's a hit.
Yeah.
Don't we have something like that? Which is what everybody did with Star Wars.
Exactly.
And it turned out, they're like, yeah, we've got this 50s family show. And that came out in 74. You know, in September of 74. So it kind of, again, like Hollywood, it all feeds off each other. And one trend builds and one trend ends. And George, and then the sci-fi trend picked up and that turned into it. You know, so, and then Indiana, as we've talked about all these. So it still at least comes back to George, and we're a big fan of him. You know, as he gets older, it's going to be more important, his history. You know, he's not making new stuff as far as we know. So each of these become more of a special gem. You know, the older he gets, and you know, the lack of new stuff and how everything's changed as history's gone on. So.
One little final trivia. The pilot for Happy Days was called New Family in Town.
Oh, well, that's kind of like a script name, but it ended up Love American Style.
It's a spinoff, of Love American Style.
It really wasn't. That was an anthology type show, and it was. They wound up calling Love in the TV, Love in the American Family in the TV or something like that. And then it became Love and then they renamed it Love in the Happy Days or something like that to tie it in as. So
Love American Style. Yeah, there it is.
But Love American Style was an anthology show with like feel good, like kind of like Love Boat was, but like these feel good stories that ended up a fun romantic, you know, silly kind of.
But that's a whole other story.
I watched it, but I wasn't as big a fan of that, so I don't think we'll ever do a show on that. Although it was, you know, somewhat popular for a time.
Very good.
So anyway, I thanks for letting us do it. It's tough to get people interested in old stuff like that, but there's always a tie into George.
I know,
or
right?
Star Trek or something.
All right. Well, thank you, James. All right. I hope you guys enjoyed today's show. I'd like to thank James for joining me on this one. There's a couple of James episodes coming up that I pre-recorded a while back, but I'm taking my sweet time putting these together, editing them and putting them out. On top of everything, I just came back from a two-week trip to Uruguay, so that kind of put me even more behind, on top of being very behind on everything. And before that, my computer crapped out completely. One of the fans stopped working and all kinds of other problems. So I had to get a new computer and then transfer all my files. So that kind of added to it. But primarily, it's just me, you know, got to get off my butt and do these things. But I assure you, the show is continuing, but it's going to be, like I mentioned a couple of episodes ago, a little more spread out in terms of when the next episode airs. I do have, like I mentioned, I think two or three shows already in the can that are going to be put out in order, and hopefully we have some more future James episodes too. So, I'd like to thank everybody for joining us, and we will see you soon here at Geek Fest Rants. Bye-bye, everybody.
Hey, baby, remember at the end of American Graffiti, you wish there was more? Well, there is!
It's more American Graffiti!
That's me, you idiot!
Ah, come on, all you big, strong men, Uncle Sam.
They're older and wiser, and just as crazy.
It's all here, all right.
Uncle Sam says, I need the toad.
Terry the Toads in Vietnam. Steve and Lori are happily married. Debbie's different.
She's pregnant.
I'm in love.
John Milner's the same.
I'm John Milner, the owner-driver of this car here, and this is our team t-shirt. I'd be deeply honored if you wore it.
She married Italianska, and Nico something.
She's a foreigner, John.
Well, that's sure, too.
One more word out of your commie mouth, kid, I'll ring your neck.
Commie,
turn around there.
I voted Republican.
I can't control it.
Get away from the trees, kid.
More American Graffiti. The bittersweet times. The crazy times. And all of it unforgettable.
A man is not a housewife. A woman is a housewife.
Ron Howard.
We're having a party tonight. And my mother loved being a housewife. And my mother loved being a mother. And I'm coming to pick you up right now. Do you understand that?
Cindy Williams.
To be proud.
Your wife is a cow. Your mother's a hog.
Charlie Martin Smith.
What's the matter?
I broke my leg.
Some guy's got all the luck.
Paul the Mat.
A little twerp.
Mackenzie Phillips.
For me, John. I've grown.
A little bit.
Candy Clark.
I think it was a fire hydrant.
We don't open up a used car lot.
Bo Hopkins.
You sell them, we steal them.
They're all back and more. With the new stars of the 80s. Telling the story of the 60s. More American Graffiti.
And watch out, the old Wolfman gonna be there too.
If you would like to subscribe to our show, send us messages, or see video links to some of the topics we talked about today, please visit our homepage at geekfestrants.com or our YouTube channel, Facebook page, or iTunes at geekfestrants.
I don't know what we're yelling about!
Geekfest Rants is produced by Carlos Peron.
Copyright 2024.
This broadcast is part of the IC Robots Radio Network. Visit icrobots.com for this and many other nerd/nostalgia-related podcasts. You won't be sorry for long.